I should tell you in preparation for this, how many of you immediately, when you hear the word sign, you immediately think about Ace of Base? Anybody? So if you were listening to that kind of music in the night, how many of you have no idea what an Ace of Base is, if we can just be honest? Okay. I'm going to sing it, I guess. No. You should go look it up. Are they from Sweden? They're from Sweden, right? And so they had this song in the 90s, early 90s, like 91, 92, 93, something like that. And it's called I Saw the Sign, and it's sort of bubblegum poppy. It's Swedish rock, I guess, is what you would call it. And if you didn't listen to Swedish rock in the 90s, shame on you. But that's the thing that's been in my head the entire time I've been preparing for this series, is I Saw the Sign. But I want to begin, and I just want to give you sort of the layout. We're going to be in the Gospel of John for the next 7 weeks, exploring these seven signs. There are seven signs in the Gospel of John. I want to give you sort of a framework for what the Gospel of John looks like, and then I want to look at what these signs are and maybe what they, like why John would do this, and then we're going to talk about a couple other things. So first, let's begin with this. The Gospel of John can actually be divided into four sections, and there are some scholars who think that actually this was a book that was written by a few different authors and that an editor pulled all these different sections together. But the first section is called the prologue, or it's called, some people call it the hymn to the Word. So it starts out, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was, how many of you are familiar with that before, right? It's sort of a retelling of the Genesis creation story, but with this Word, this word logos means like reason or intelligence, this reason, this wisdom at the center of everything. And then it says that this wisdom became embodied in the human life of Jesus, right? So that's where John begins. And then there's this section called the Book of Signs. And this is the section we're going to be in over the next 7 weeks, where the writer organizes all the action around these seven things Jesus does. And only seven. There's only, like, Jesus does seven signs in the gospel, and that's all Jesus does as far as miracle-type stuff. And we'll talk about that in a bit. Then there's the Book of Glory. And so this is, Jesus does several what they're called farewell discourses. So he talks to his disciples. He's preparing them for his impending death. And so it's called the Book of Glory. Then you'll probably see why, when we go through this series, why they would call it the Book of Glory. And then you have the epilogue, which is chapter 21. How many remember the story of Jesus on the beach with his disciples? And he says, Peter, do you love me? After Peter had denied him. How do you remember that story? It's one of my favorite Easter stories. And it ends there. So that's how the Gospel of John works. And now what's interesting is there are only seven things. Jesus does seven things, seven signs. He says a lot. John's interesting, though. Jesus tells no parables in John. He has these big, long discourses where he says a lot of stuff to his disciples, but there are no parables, and there are only seven signs, or what we would typically call miracles, but we're going to talk about why we don't call these miracles. He does these seven things, and only two of them are mentioned in the other Gospels, and the stories are told very differently in John. And there's a point to that, I think, too, as we get into it. This is what this is in John 21. At the end of the letter, here's what the writer says. Jesus did many other things as well. Right? So I've told you about seven. I've told you these seven things Jesus does. I've told you about Jesus' death. I've told you about Jesus' resurrection. There are a lot of other things Jesus did as well. If all of them were recorded, I imagine the world itself wouldn't have enough room for the scrolls that would be written. Right, and this is, I think, an interesting thing to think about. When you approach the Bible and you read the stories of Jesus in the Gospels, like, that's not everything, right? Like, Jesus said and did stuff. For example, Paul says some stuff that Jesus said, even though Paul never met Jesus, this would have been something someone told him, that aren't in the Gospels at all. These things that are attributed to Jesus that didn't show up in the Gospels. So everything that we can say about Jesus, or everything we know about Jesus, we don't know everything. There's lots of stuff that didn't get included, especially in John. And then the question, like, if you think like I do, which could be a scary way to be in the world, one of the things I think about often is, why did he choose these? Right? Why did John choose these specific signs? Notice John 20. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in his disciples' presence, signs that aren't recorded in the scroll. But these things are written so that you will believe that Jesus is the Christ, God's Son, and that believing you will have life in his name. Don't you love that at the end? The writer says, look, I could have told you a lot of stuff, but I picked seven things, and I want to tell you I have an agenda up front, right? Or he tells you at the end, but you should know there's an agenda here. I want you to trust this Jesus. I've told you the things I've told you about Jesus, not so you would like have really good Bible trivia or not so. I've told you the things I've told you simply because I want you to trust this Jesus. This experience of God we had and this person named Jesus, I want you to trust it. Have you ever been a part of something and you realize there's fine print or there's maybe an agenda you don't know about? Well, John's not doing that. He says, I want you to know, you got to the end, you have lots of questions about other stuff. Jesus did tons of stuff. I'm telling you about these because I want you to trust this Jesus. And here are the seven signs and the scriptural references of them. We're going to begin next week by looking at Jesus turning water into wine. It's the least favorite miracle of Baptists, I should tell you, on the front end. Jesus heals a royal son's a royal official's son. He heals a paralyzed man. He feeds 5,000 plus. Now, he doesn't feed 4,000 in John. There's in the other Gospels, there's 5,000 and 4,000, just the 5,000 in John. In chapter 5, or number 5, Jesus walks on water. Number 6, Jesus heals a man born blind. And then the final sign is Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. And what's super interesting about the last sign is when he does this in John, this is the moment when the sort of the temple authorities and the Roman authorities agree he's got to go. It's something about raising Lazarus that is sort of a tipping point for them. And we'll explore that as we get there. Now, what I think we have to talk about, I've been doing a series of vlogs, which are video blogs on Facebook about the Bible. And I don't know if maybe you've seen any of them, but one of the things that often gets brought up when people send me messages or people ask is they want to talk about, like, what parts of the Bible are literal and what parts of the Bible aren't literal. Like, how many of you have questions like that? Anybody have questions like that? To tell you a bit of my story, I grew up just believing everything was literal. If the Bible said something happened, it literally happened. There was no nuance to that. There was no understanding of that. And when my faith began to shift and my opinions began to change and I understood the Bible differently, I went through this real obsessive time in my life for a couple years where I could not sleep at night because when I laid down to sleep, another Bible story would pop in my head and I would go, I wonder if that's literal. And like I built my entire faith around figuring this out, right? So my entire faith, my entire worldview is going to be built around what I can discern is literal in the Bible and what is not literal in the Bible. And then I had this revelation. It was sort of one of those things where the heavens open up and the beam of light comes down. And here's what I realized. Nobody can prove anything on either side. How many of you have ever been, and I'll tell you, in my more fundamentalist days, I used to get in arguments with people about this, and I would question their Christianity if they didn't believe everything like I did. How many of you have ever been there before? Where the litmus test for faithfulness is not the fruit of your life or how much you love God. The litmus test is whether or not you match my answers to the exam. How many of you know exactly what I'm talking about? And I remember being so mean to people over this stuff. And I would say things to them, and I would call them hypocrites and heretics. And I got to tell you, being on the other side of that, that's not always pleasant to hear about yourself, right? I mean, it can be a little hurtful and a little frustrating. And so as we begin this series, I just want to say something about this idea of literal. Are these seven signs of Jesus to be taken literally? Or are these seven signs of Jesus, is there a chance that the writer doesn't want us to take them literally, but they function more as a parable? They're trying to teach us something powerful about Jesus, and they kind of create these stories. And here's what I'm going to tell you. We're going to spend absolutely, this is the only time, zero time other than this, on this question. And here's what I'm going to tell you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you believe about this if you don't understand what they mean. Are you with me? You can be completely right about something happening. Like, Jesus literally turned water into wine. If you can't talk about what that means, then it's just a cool party trick. Right? It doesn't matter if you believe Jesus walked on water. If we can't talk about and discern what it means, then it doesn't matter. So I'm just going to tell you, I'm not going to spend time going, did this literally happen? This is not a question in my frame of reference anymore. Now, I'll talk about it with you outside of this. If you want to buy me coffee and maybe a cronut or something, you know cronuts, right? Or croissant donuts. You haven't lived. But if you want to do that, I'll totally engage and I'll give you my opinions on things and tell you why. But the reality is, it just is I'm not interested anymore in my life about debating what is or isn't. I'm really interested in what does it mean because I want to become a better person. And I want to be faithful to Jesus, and I want to be transformed by Jesus. And the only way you can be transformed is to sort of leave behind this polarizing question of literal or not literal and actually say, okay, whatever happened, believe what you want, what does this mean? And so my complete focus over these next 7 weeks is going to be, what do these stories mean? And if we figure, and so what I'm going to be focused on is the more than literal. They may very well be literal. I don't know. They may very well not be literal. But let's say they are literal. There's a more than literal meaning. Are you with me? There's something that transcends the time and space they happened in. It's something larger. It's called a sign. Jesus, the writer of John, calls them signs. And if we get stuck on literal or not literal, we've missed the point. A guy named Scott McKnight, he's a biblical scholar, and he wrote a book called The Blue Parakeet. Has anybody read this book? It came out in the early 2000s. And I can't remember why he calls it The Blue Parakeet, but I read the book and I thought it was super interesting. It's a book on how we understand the Bible. And he uses this story of Jonah and the big fish, the big whale, right? Which is one of those things that people often do this about. Did Jonah really get swallowed by a fish, or was it a parable? And here's what he says. Missing the difference between God and the Bible is a bit like the person who reads Jonah and spends hours and hours figuring out if a human can live inside a whale and what kind of whale it was, but never encounters God. The book is about Jonah's God, not Jonah's whale. Do you see that? I mean, have you ever done this? Like, I spent time, now what kind of, I've actually been in conversations like this. Well, it would have to be this certain kind of fish for Jonah to be swallowed and to be able to stay. And I remember watching this cartoon of this as a kid, and he like builds a fire inside the fish, which I'm pretty sure the fish would be like, excuse me, I have heartburn, right? Like there would be some sort of, I don't know, like where do you get dry enough like kindling to start a fire? Like whatever. But if you get lost in the debate on whether or not a human can be swallowed by a big fish and survive it, you've missed the entire point of Jonah. And there was a really long stretch of time where if you ask me what Jonah was about, would be, do not disobey God or your parents or you'll be swallowed by a fish. Now, it was okay to take that part metaphorically in your own life. Like, if you break curfew, you're probably going to get a flat tire. Like, right? But this whole idea of, that's the point of this, that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is, in the book of Jonah, and this is free of charge, the point of the story is, God sent Jonah to his enemies to tell them about God's love, and he refused. And the point is, love your enemies. Because when you end up resisting and hating your enemies and refusing to meet them halfway, when you refuse to love your enemies, it leads to bad. And it was a parable about the story functions as a critique on the Jewish people and what led to exile. Because they would not seek peace, they sought conflict, and they got it, and they were destroyed. Right? So there's something going on there. And you can read the book of Jonah, and you can read the Gospel of John, and you can see all the seven signs of Jesus, and you can feel really good about believing them literally. If you don't understand what's going on, you will miss the God who's trying to encounter you in these signs. If you focus on the wrong thing, you'll miss the thing that's being offered to you there. So are you with me? Like, we're not going to worry about any of that. And the thing I understand is I have people in this room who would say to me, if I can't take those literally, then I'm out. And I have people on the other, well, actually not on the other side of the room. You all intersperse really well with each other. But for frame of reference, on the other side saying, if you tell me I have to take these literally, I am out. And so what I want to do is I want to stand in the middle and I want to hold both of your hands and we can sing We Are the World and Kumbaya and we can ask the question, what do these things mean? Because whether you take them literally or not, it doesn't matter if you don't know what they mean. And it's really important that they're called signs, not miracles. The writer of John, and he numbers the first couple, but then he just wants us to do the rest of the work for him, right? He doesn't number them all. But he calls them signs. He does not call them miracles. And this is from next week's reading, but what Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, turning water into wine, was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So something about the wedding in Cana, Jesus reveals something about who he is, and his disciples trust it. Which is exactly what the writer says at the end. I've told you these things so that you will see who Jesus is and what he's about and that you will trust him. So we have to talk about what signs do. And that's what I want to focus on the rest of the teaching. What do signs do? And I've got some things I want to show you. I feel like I'm in the middle of big time WWE wrestling. You know when they go outside the ring and they pull out a steel chair? Like that's what I'm doing right now. He's got a chair. Okay. I was promised these signs were procured legally. So I have no responsibility for this. See Jeremy Davis. What does this sign mean? Okay. Because I've seen some of you, and you do rolling stops. So apparently we all don't know what this means. What do you do when you see this sign? Why? Drive faster and hope you don't get caught. Why do you stop when you see this sign? It's pointing to something, right? And it's pointing to the fact that at this place, you have to stop because other people are going to be coming through, right? But is the point the stop sign? Is this the point? What's the point? Huh? Yeah, the point is actually stopping. So you can see the stop sign, and you can blow right through it. You can miss it. And that's what you tell the police officer when he or she pulls you over, right? I totally missed the sign. Really? It's an octagon, and it's red, and it's reflective. You didn't miss the sign. You ignored the sign, right? So the point isn't the sign. The point is stop. Because for everybody's safety, this is a three-way stop, a four-way stop. Everybody needs to stop. Now, let's look at this one right here. What does this mean? No right turn. No right turn? Well, from here, it's a left turn, but I'll trust you. Kidding. No right turn. How many of you ever ignored one of these and ended up on a one-way street the wrong way? When I first got my driver's license, I was, I'd had my driver's license a while. It was the first time I lived in a big city, Pikeville, Kentucky. Very big city, huge city, and had an Applebee's and everything. And so in Pikeville, there's a bunch of one-way streets, and I'd never learned to drive on one-way streets. And there was this one time I remember I was in college there, and I was going down the street, and everybody was acting all weird and blowing their horns. And I thought, what is wrong with these people? We don't act like this around here. And then I realized I was going the wrong way down a one-way street. To be fair, I was only going one way. It just happened to be the wrong one. Now, what is the point of this sign? What is the point of this? What is the point? The point isn't the sign itself. The point is, don't turn right. Correct? The sign isn't the point. The point is what the sign is pointing to. And that is, if you go this way, you're going to be going the wrong way. What does this mean? No outlet. Did you say that? Is that you? That's like the very tech. There's no outlet. This means there's nowhere to go. Like if you go down this street, it's going to dead end, very literal, and you're going to have to turn around or God knows what's going to happen to you at the dead end of the street. So you don't go. Is the point the sign, or is the point the thing the sign is trying to tell you? The point is the sign is pointing to something larger. It's saying at the end of this road, it's literally the end. So don't go down here unless you live here, because you're going to find there's nothing else to see. The point isn't the sign. The point is the sign is pointing to something larger than the sign itself. There's one more, and Jeremy wasn't able to steal one of these for me, so I'll just put this up. All right, how many of you have been on how many of you been on the interstate or on the Natcher, and you see a sign that says, you know, Morgantown 10 miles, right, or Owensboro 20 miles, or Bowling Green 10 miles, or Nashville 2 miles? How many of you have seen one of these signs before? Now, what is the point of that sign? It's to tell you you're going in the right or wrong direction, right? If you were trying to get to Louisville and you see this sign, turn around. You've gone the wrong way. It's essentially saying you're going in this direction. You're going toward this city, and in this many miles, you're going to have exits for this city. But if you were to park your car and just admire this sign, man, we're 2 miles from Nashville. We are 2 miles from Nashville. Isn't it great to be 2 miles from Nashville? Oh, my goodness, we're 2 miles from Nashville. This is the best thing. Like, is the point to be 2 miles from Nashville, or is the point to get to Nashville? The point is to get to Nashville. This sign is not the point. The point is the thing it's pointing us toward. And the danger over the next 7 weeks we're going to run into with these stories of Jesus, the danger we're going to bump into is that we want to be so enamored with the sign that we miss the larger thing it's pointing to. Which is why when you get bogged down in these conversations about, is this literal, is this not literal? Like, do you see why these conversations can be super interesting if you're a Bible nerd, which is a badge I wear proudly, but it's not super helpful if you're trying to figure out who Jesus is and what this stuff all means, right? So here's what I want to invite us to do over the next 7 weeks. I want to invite us to see the signs. And I want to invite us to look beyond them and ask the question, what is this sign saying to us about who Jesus is and about how we respond to Jesus? Does that make sense? There's a story in the other Gospels. They call Matthew, Mark, and Luke the synoptics because they're so similar. There's a story in Mark where Jesus has fed 5,000 people and then he feeds 4,000 people. And at the end, his disciples get hung up on the details of the feeding, like how much was left over and all those sorts of things. And here's what Jesus says to his disciples. Don't you understand? Right? They're asking him questions about bread. He's like, don't you understand? Are your hearts so resistant to what God is doing? Don't you have eyes? Why can't you see? Don't you have ears? Why can't you hear? And I wonder if perhaps this is Jesus' response to us when we keep encountering the Bible, but we don't ask the larger question of what is this pointing to? Right? Have you ever read the Bible and then turned around and used the Bible as a weapon on somebody else? Have you ever done this before? I'll never forget the time I told this girl in high school, Jesus has this brilliant line about judging in the Gospels, and he says, you don't judge other people. You don't pull the speck out of their eye. We have a board in yours. How many of you remember this saying of Jesus? And my saying to this girl in high school was, she said, you're being very judgmental. And I said, well, I've got the speck out of my eye, and now I'm coming for the board in yours. Now, that's a really poor use of the Bible. And I think there's, in some ways, we just want to be so right. Like we've made our focus correctness. And if you really look around at what Christians say to each other and other people, we really don't believe grace is the thing that heals us and restores us and gives us eyes to see and ears to hear what God is doing. We actually believe it's right belief. Having all the right beliefs is the thing that makes God love you. Having right beliefs is the thing that makes God accept you, right? That's how we end up practically living. And I think when we do that, Jesus is saying to us, don't you understand? Are your hearts so resistant to what God is doing? Don't you have eyes to see? Don't you have eyes? Can't you see? Don't you have ears? Can't you hear? My prayer for us over these next 7 weeks, and if you've grown up in church, you've heard all these stories we're going to look at before, right? I can remember growing up and hearing stories of the wedding in Cana that turned into how Jesus didn't turn it into real wine. It was grape juice and why you shouldn't drink wine. And if that's where you end up on this story, friends, you have missed the boat. Because the point of the story isn't about wine and whether or not it's alcoholic wine. The point of the story is something larger. So my prayer, my ask of you over the next 7 weeks, again, I told you you wouldn't be blown away by this talk today because it's not really anything new. But my request of us is that we will have eyes to see and ears to hear these signs of Jesus in a way that whether you've heard them never before or a million times before, you'll be open to the thing that it's pointing to. So that when we gather together on Resurrection Sunday, we have a bigger sense of every one of these signs we've been to, every single one of them have been pointing us in a direction. And then the question becomes, what are we going to do with it? Are we going to open ourselves, open our hearts, open our eyes, open our ears to this thing God has been inviting us to be a part of? Or are we going to be resistant? Are we going to be closed? Or are we going to be running in the opposite direction of the thing God's inviting us to do? Are you with me? Because the point isn't the sign. I mean, yes, if you could go to a place and turn water into wine, people would want your services. But that would miss the point. So next week we're going to begin with that. Let's have a word of prayer before we go. God, we are grateful for this Jesus and for the scripture. We are grateful for these signs that are pointing us in a very specific direction. May we not get bogged down in making them the point. May the point be the one and the way that they're pointing to. May we not become so enamored with a stop sign that we fail to stop. But may we see and hear and experience what Jesus says and does over these next 7 weeks. And may we receive and accept the challenge of these things. And may we let them begin to shape who we are, how we live, and how we see the world in each other. So over these next 7 weeks, we ask, give us hearts that are open, give us eyes that see, give us ears that hear. And may what we discover these next seven weeks about Jesus, may it be transformative. May it change us at the core of who we are. This is our prayer. We ask this in Jesus' name, and everybody said, amen. Let's stand. Don't forget Wednesday night, Ash Wednesday. We would love for y'all to be here and be a part.